and the boss, and on and on and on and on. And I think that's true for me. When I was brand new, I was very surrendered. And then I got just enough self-esteem to be dangerous. And I started hedging my bet, and I got to this point, and I, in step six, and I don't really want it to be removed. I want the consequences to go. And they're a package. Everybody I know wants to be free of the sleeplessness and the anxiety and that driven, horrible feeling from deep-seated resentments, but are you willing to give up the pleasure of judgment? That's the root. Everybody I know wants to be free of that awful, awful feeling when you in the aftermath of selfish, inappropriate self-gratification. But are you willing to? What if you really ask God to take away your lust, and He did? Ooh. What would you do now? But what is my anger, and what is my lust, and what is my vindictiveness, and what is all this stuff, and my selfishness? Isn't it defense mechanisms against a world that is often hostile and empty and vacant? My lust is just a defense against my fear of a life that's boring and vacant and lonely. And I know I've talked to a lot of guys, and a lot of guys will settle for sex because they're afraid of intimacy. They don't know how to do that. So they settle for sex. And what they really want is intimacy. But they don't know how to do that. And we're so we hide behind the bravado. I don't need that. Yeah, you do. That's why without it, you come up so empty afterwards. And so I'm hanging on to some of this stuff because I think I can't imagine life without it. These are the things I use to shore up my life, to give me a sense of security or validation against the world that is not good sometimes, that I'm afraid of. And what happened to me is I started to hit these little bottoms. I started wearing some of this stuff out, and then I would say that prayer. I'd ask God to help me to be willing. And then what happens, in my experience, what happened in a lot of my sobriety is I would ask God to help me to be willing to give something up or become entirely ready to give something up. And what would happen is I would start, things would start changing inside of me. And now there are things that at one time I could do so easily, and now I try to take that same kind of behavior and I feel horrible. And it's a lot like drinking. I couldn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and surrender to this program and bring my drinking here and really take step one until the whole illusion was smashed that I was ever going to be able to control and enjoy it. As long as there was some fun in drinking and I can control it enough to kind of get away with the fun, I ain't ready yet. Because I ain't done with it. It's still a horse I want to ride. I may not want to ride it today because I'm in trouble, but I want to keep it in the stall because I ain't entirely ready. When coming off my last drunk, I was entirely ready to do anything to have God remove the obsession to drink. Why? Because I knew I got the truth. I can drink until it kills me, but I will never get value out of it again. It'll never be fun like it was when I was 20 years old again. And so I was ready. And I had experienced a lot of that with my own character defects. And really see through the illusion of value and see that there's nothing there. That the truth is, objectively, is everything that I'm... All these defects actually bring to me the thing I'm afraid of. You know, I get anger and resentment and rage and all that kind of stuff because I'm afraid people aren't going to like me, so I jump on them. I'm afraid you're going to think something badly of me, or so I beat you to it. I get on the muscle with you. What happens is that I start losing people in my life because people don't want to be around people like that. So it's a lot like the story of the guy who goes into the doctor's office and he says, Doc, I don't know what to do. The doctor's a psychiatrist. He says, please help me. My brother-in-law lives with me. He's crazy, Doc. You got to do something. He thinks he's a chicken. Every morning as the sun comes up, he runs up and down the street naked, flapping his arms, clucking like a bird. The neighbors won't talk to me. The police are there. You got to do something. The psychiatrist says, well, that's no problem. Here, sign these committal papers. I'll put your brother-in-law in the state mental hospital. Your problems are over. He says, oh, yeah, Doc, but I don't know if I can live without the eggs. There's eggs. There's always eggs. And that's what becoming entirely ready is the process of uncovering and discovering the eggs and realizing there's nothing there. This is not working. This is not working. I saw this TV show when I was a little kid. I don't know why I remember stuff like this. I was just a little kid. There was a TV show on called Rescue 8. Some of you may remember it. It was about these two paramedics, and they worked out of this firehouse, and they would go out on calls to help people, and that's what the TV show is about. And they get on this one call, and they go out, and there's this little girl with her arm lodged in a vending machine, and they can't get it out. And they're bringing like torches and cutting material. They're going to have to cut her arm out of this vending machine. And they're getting all set up to do this, and the one paramedic's looking at her, and he says, sweetheart, what's in your hand? She says, a candy bar. He says, well, let go of the candy bar. She couldn't get her arm out. Let go of the candy bar. No, it's my candy bar. And he says to her, he says, sweetheart, if you let go of that candy bar, I promise you that I will get you some candy. And she finally, because she trusts him, lets go of the candy bar. And the minute she does that, her arm slides right out. And it was able to come out. As long as she had it wrapped around that candy bar, she couldn't get her arm out of that vending machine. And he gave her a candy bar. And isn't that what happens with God? God's saying, let go of the deal. Oh, I can't live without it. Trust me. But eventually what happens is you let go. And it's always the same thing. It's always a better deal. It's always, because this is the stuff that stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my usefulness to his kids. None of this stuff is any good. But how often I'm afraid to trust God. A friend of mine told a story from a book. There was a guy who wrote a book about the invasion at Normandy Beach. Anybody ever see Saving Private Ryan? Yeah. Brutal beginning of that movie. Brutal. And evidently, that's a lot like it really was when those troops landed there. It was horrific. And there were so many of them were killed. And this guy wrote a book about the lives of the people and tried to write about some of the people who died on that beach and some of the people who lived. And one of the things they discovered is a lot of these guys who died, they found their bodies and they had written notes to their family knowing that they were going to die. And some of them had even written prayers, and this one guy wrote this note to God and says, God, please, come quick. Come now. Don't send your son. This is no place for children. And I understand that kind of fear and desperation. And there have been moments in my sobriety where I have gotten backed into a corner and I asked God for something. And the response is so immediate that I can't even believe it. And then there are other times when I've asked for things and it just doesn't seem to budge because for some reason I'm not entirely ready. I'm not entirely ready. And I've speculated about, I've sat, I don't know how many times at coffee with guys sober a long time speculating on why God removes some of these things and why he doesn't remove others. And the line in there I keep coming back to is that I'm asking him only to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. And maybe some of this stuff he thinks in the big, sees in the big picture makes me useful. I know one thing about me. When I'm having a really bad day, and maybe I've waited too long to eat, and it's the end of the afternoon, and I'm insane with low blood sugar, and I go into a restaurant, and I'm nuts, and the waitress won't wait on me quick enough, and I finally just storm out of there and say something just out of line to her as I'm leaving, and I go out and get my car to drive somewhere else to get something to eat because I'm insane, and I realize I don't ever want to go back there again, right? And I'm screwed up, and now I start feeling the remorse and the shame of my behavior, because what have I done? I've become the guy that I wouldn't like. I've become the idiot that gives some poor waitress that's just trying to make a living a hard time. She didn't do nothing to me. She was doing her job. I wasn't the bright spot in her day. I was the spot of discomfort in her whole day. And I feel terrible. At that moment, a saint can't help me. I need to find somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've heard or know that has struggled with some things like that. Because that guy, he's my go-to guy. There was a guy in Las Vegas named Bill Birch who at one time was our oldest member of AA. He was sober close to 50 years ago. And I loved Bill. He was a wonderful guy. But Bill used to say that he never had a bad day since he got sober, that there was no big deals, and he's been happy ever since he came to AA. When I was having a bad day, I avoided Bill. He's not my guy. I love him, but I ain't talking to you. You know, because I can't talk to him. I got to go find somebody that I think's like me, because the first thing I have to do before I can ever come to God is I have to make that connection with someone and realize I'm not alone. So maybe some of this stuff becomes useful. One of the hardest, most fear-wrought surrenders that I know of in history occurred, as Scott touched on a little bit, occurred in the Pacific Fleet in the mid-1940s when the Emperor of Japan was forced to surrender to our fleet. And they met on this ship, and I can't imagine a more fear-wrought surrender, because they had to surrender unconditionally to us, knowing that we knew what they did at Pearl Harbor, knowing that we knew what they did to our prisoner of wars, knowing that we knew about all the people they'd killed of ours, and the families and women and children and soldiers and the torture and all that stuff, and they had to surrender unconditionally to us. And the fear must have been unbelievable. I think some of us approach God like that. The fear is that if I really surrender to God, oh my God. Some of us feel that way about, like we can't trust him. And I'm sure that they were full of that same kind of fear. And yet they didn't have a choice, because there have been two atomic weapons set off at two of their major industrial centers of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They had no atomic bombs. They had no defense against that. They were facing, as some of us were when we got sober, annihilation, total and complete. They were at the end of their rope. There was nowhere else to go. And they surrendered to us, and they signed the treaty or the formal terms of surrender, which is essentially their third step. But that was not all. They were required to take some more action. They had to do, in essence, an inventory of all their defenses. Their planes, their army, their bombs, their standing army, everything. Every weapon of war, everything that they used to defend themselves with had to be inventoried and then let go of and literally turned over to their enemy, which rendered them defenseless. At that point, we could have gone in there with a nominal force and just wiped them out, and they couldn't have defended themselves. I can't imagine a worse surrender. Matter of fact, it was so difficult. I know a guy who was a young kid in the army, and he was over in Japan after World War II, and he said one of the major tasks of the United States forces over there was not to keep people for the hospital. They were surrendered. It was to clear up the bodies of the suicides because some people couldn't live with the shame of that. And there were massive suicides in Japan as a result of that. But what happened is that to this day, the Japanese have never reneged on that. They've never created a standing army. They've never taken a militaristic stance towards the rest of the world. And like all undefended, surrendered people, kind of like AA, like what happens to us, they were forced into a life of service where the individual and self was set aside for the greater whole. And as a result of this surrender and selfless service, the Japanese, within 4 decades, owned more of the United States than they could have ever conquered or held by military means. They kicked our butt in almost every venue because they existed to serve in a surrendered mentality. What the Japanese industry, there was no self thing about the, you know, well, what about me and I'm not going to work another. Man, they just served the greater whole. And they kicked our butt in almost everything we went up against them economically. And then I was in Japan 17 or 18 years ago for a conference, and I was there for about 10 days, and I saw the beginning of the new generation's roots in the Japanese culture, the me generation. The generation that didn't want all this service. And what about me? And yeah, the whole, but what about me? And I saw the beginning of that, and what, at that time, the number one vehicle that was sought after in Japan was a Mustang. Everybody wanted Harley Davidsons. Everybody wanted to listen to American rock and roll music and wear American clothes with American labels. Japan, Tokyo, had some of the finest restaurants in the world. Food is an art form. Amazing restaurants. If you ever watched that TV show, to this day there's still some amazing chefs. Some of the Iron Chefs come from. Oh, it's just amazing stuff. And in that city of some of the greatest restaurants in the world, there was one restaurant that had a line 2 blocks long to get in. You couldn't get in. Yeah, McDonald's. I looked at that and I thought, oh, stick a fork in them. They're done. They don't have a shot. And what happened to them is the same. Isn't the spirit? I think the spirit, what's true for the spirit of an individual is also true of the spirit of a family or of a workplace or of a country or a nation. As the spirit gets inundated with self, what happens is it starts to get sick. And we see the same thing here. How many times do you see people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they're so beaten and they face absolute annihilation? They're either doomed to an alcoholic death or forced to live by spiritual principles. And they come to AA, they surrender, they live a life of service, and within a few years, just like the Japanese, they have everything that they fought to get and could not get. And then what happens often in AA is we get seduced by the fruits of our own recovery, until all of a sudden you say little things to yourself like that. When somebody asks you to go to on a 12-step call or continue to do a panel at an institution or something, you'd say, doesn't anybody else step up to the plate here except me? You know, I've been a pretty good sport up to now. All this helping others is good, but all this amends is good, but what about me? When am I going to spend some attention doing something for me? And then what happens is we start compromising this surrendered altruistic way of life. And our lives start to get inundated and dominated again by self. And the rest is history. Some of us drink again. Some of us hit bottoms in sobriety and re-surrender. Some of us get on medication. Some of us become compulsive gamblers. Some of us come up with the most creative ways to hurt ourselves sober I've ever seen. I am just some amazing stuff. But it's the same thing every time. this is really where the surrender occurs, I believe. Scott used the story that the old adage in AA about, I think he used about the three frogs, didn't you share? Three frogs sitting on a log, one makes a decision to jump in the water, how many are still on the log? And the answer is three. If they really became entirely ready and did step six and seven, I think that's where you hear the splash. What is a surrender? If you watch TV and you watch war movies and you watch people surrender, what do? They lay down all their defenses and they sit by the side of the road and wait for someone to come along and tell them what to do. Isn't that what we do? I lay down everything and I wait for my sponsor to tell me what to do, or I wait for God to tell me what to do through the people in AA. Or sometimes if I'm open enough to it through the intuitive sixth sense within me. But I stop running it from up here, from the control center. I found that inside of me, there's in my being, there's only so much room. I got room for self, or I got room for spirit. But the more spirit, the less self, and the more self, the less spirit. And what happens is I fill up with me. And I think that those two forces within me are diametrically opposed to each other, almost like on a balance scale. And the problem, and I think down to the core of this delusion that I think I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well, one of the reasons I can't manage my own life, I really can't make me better, sober, is that I always misinterpret what is the right thing to do by nature. That's why I have a sponsor. And I'm the kind of guy on a spiritual bad hair day when I don't feel very good about myself. My first thought is not to go out and find someone to help or go make amends. My first thought is always about me. Something to do with gratifying me, making me better. You catch me on a spiritual bad hair day, I have to stay off a car lot because I'm liable to buy something. Right? And what I'm doing is I'm taking, and what happens is if you gratify yourself in when you feel like that, it doesn't help. Matter of fact, it makes it worse. Because my ego and my spirit are diametrically opposed to each other. And what happens is when I feed my ego, when my ego is low and my spirit is solid, I don't need, in those kind of days, I'm not a judgmental guy when I'm like that. Because I don't need to tear you down. Because I'm okay. And I'm okay. You're okay. Everybody's cool here. I don't need a new car. I don't need a lot of validation. But when my spirit is vacant and it's not doing good, those are the days where I'm going to need validation. I want attention. I want to buy something. Those are the days that I'm the most judgmental of others. Coming from this vacancy inside, I'll tear people down. There's an old American Indian story, and I'll share this and pass it back to Scott, close this up, about this young brave. And this story I heard 20 years ago, and I think in the last 5 or 10 years it circulated all over the internet. It's about this young brave who goes to the old wise man of the tribe, and he says, old man, I'm confused, I don't understand what's going on. He said, sometimes I feel a lot of love and a great community with the Great Spirit and with the tribe. And other days I feel so out of sorts and disconnected and judgmental and angry at everybody. And I don't understand what that is. And the old man said, well, son, your life is like two dogs trapped in a sack in mortal combat to the death. And one dog represents the Great Spirit in your heart and your love, and the other one represents self and fear. And the young brave says, which one wins? And he says, whatever one you feed. And my problem all my life is my natural inclination when I'm not doing well is to feed the wrong dog. It's just my natural. That is goes to the essence of why I can't manage my own life. Because when I'm on me and I'm doing very poorly, I will pick the wrong dog. And it'll look like the right dog. I will pick the wrong dog. Scott.
I want to do a couple of things. One is to remind you that John's talking tonight at 7:30. Trust me. Be here. Don't miss it. The man lays his heart out beautifully. We're going to talk about these questions, and I want to tell you first that my answer to every question always starts with, I agree with whatever your sponsor says. I hope those of you who wrote these questions are going to take them to your sponsors. And if your sponsor disagrees with something we say, I hope you go with what your sponsor says. Here's one that says, I actually came in the inner group last week. I saw someone at a meeting that I saw on TV is wanted by the police. What, if anything, do I do? Again, I agree with what your sponsor says. I'll tell you my experience at having sponsored a number of police officers, and that's that they have to keep AA and police work separate. And I think there are a couple of options, and the first one, of course, includes prayer. And maybe the answer is to go to that person and say, I saw you on TV, and I hope you're talking to your sponsor. And I'll pray for you. I don't know. You got something else on that one? Good. Then this one's yours. Oh, yeah.
As long as you don't see me on TV, that's all I care about. You spot it. It says shared jewels. You spot it. You got it. How are you living? So often we hear what others think about me is none of my business. I have found that what I think about me is none of my business either. Lends to greater serenity. Is there a question there?
I don't know, but I have an answer.
Okay, you better give it. I think this guy's just sharing. He wanted to share.
Yeah, it's a couple of jewels. I think it's great. I have an observation. What you think of me is none of my business. What I think of you can kill me. That's what we were talking about in resentments. The other thing I want to say, this is another gift from my wife. You spot it, you got it. We always see that in the negative connotation. If you spot some good stuff in somebody, you got it. How about that? Here's another one. What about a person who has a serious problem with discovering their faults, honestly feels they hurt themselves more than anyone else? Gee, that's a great reason not to do the steps. I'd buy that if I was their sponsor. No offense, but that's what I hear here. And I don't really care what they think. I'm a one-trick pony. I'm going to tell you right now, it is one fabulous trick. But I just got the one. And I can't sponsor them their way. And what they're afraid of doesn't scare me a bit. And my experience has been the people who surrender to this process and actually do the things we're talking about, get past all this stuff. And maybe they have hurt themselves more than anyone else. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. If that's the case, we'll dig through it. We'll find answers.
You know, I don't know. Some of you may have been around in the early to mid-80s when there was a movement that occurred in Alcoholics Anonymous that came out of treatment centers getting over and like analyzing your childhood as if that's responsible for how screwed up you are today, and intellectually that movement made a lot of sense and was very intellectually stimulating. You want, because there's a need within every single one of us to try to figure out why we're so screwed up. I went to therapy for years trying to figure out what. Because I felt damaged. I thought someone must have done this to me. You know, I went looking and I could never find out what had happened to me because nothing. I came from a good family. I even was regressed through hypnosis back through my childhood, figuring I must have blocked it out. And I never got it. And I watched a lot of people back in those years. I have one good friend who got sicker and sicker, and in the last couple of years he's been in and out of detox. He's got two sobriety dates, one for 40 years plus without drinking and one that changes about every 8-10 months from other medications and drugs that he keeps getting addicted to. All as a result that he got so into that. And there's a line in the 12 by 12 that talks about we must We can't exonerate ourselves behind what has been done to us. I have to take inventory here. And if I run into a guy that's convinced that he's never done anything wrong, you know what he's saying to me is he's not ready, really. I've never run into anybody that has. It's like alcoholic, altruistic saint. I don't get it.
I want to observe, too, on this particular one that, as we've noticed today, this inventory isn't a freestyle kind of thing. It's go write inventory. That's not it. The book's real specific about what to do, and there's a tremendous healing in there. And I talked about digging the poison out of your soul. And that's where this process happens. This steps 4 and 5, 8, 9, and 10 are about that, digging the poison out of your soul. I don't care what the poison is. That's how we dig it out. We got two more here. Here we go. This is a hot one, at least nationwide. Could you address the use of the Lord's Prayer at the end of meetings? As a Jew, I find it disturbing and cannot participate. This adds to my feelings of apartness or of being apart. It's interesting. My home group just addressed this, and I think the answer is actually at the home group level. And my home group addressed it, and interestingly enough, we had some people that thought we should open with the third step prayer and close with the seventh step prayer, and we went in through a number of things. And what we wound up with was a little bit of what you saw last night, and that was what we discovered was that as we were using the Lord's Prayer, we were insulting it by beginning with who put the breezes in the trees and some of this other stuff that we hear that people who are devout Christians find very offensive at the beginning. And this idea that we have improved on that with the keep coming back, it works if you work it, but you got to work it every day thing at the end. If you'll think about it, as we're putting the mojo on this thing, and I think that's really confusing people. And so we came up with, and what our chairperson says, for those who would care to join, we'll now close with the Lord's Prayer, and then they say prayer. That's how we decided to do it. And that's our group conscience. And I hope you'll take, if this is a problem, and we have Jewish members in my home group, and I hope that you will take this to your home group, and if you can't get it the way you think it needs to be, and it's that important, then get yourself a coffee pot and some friends. And we grow that way. And I'm not discounting this as a problem. I'm not. I know nationally, I know this is talked about a lot, but I ask, when I get around people that have been around a long time, I ask open-ended questions. And I asked our buddy Cliff one time, I said, what do you see about AA that troubles you? And he said, there's nothing wrong with AA that good sponsorship wouldn't fix. And I think that, and I thought that's the best answer I've heard. It comes back down to the individual group. And we asked another one not too long ago the same question. And he said, what's wrong with AA today? Too many meetings, not enough groups. Pretty good response if you think about it. That the answer continues to come down to the group level for me on that one.
You know, I remember there was a time when I thought, I misinterpreted the traditions. I thought that the Lord's Prayer was implying affiliation with Christianity. And there was a time in early sobriety where I thought, oh, that's not right. We should say the Serenity Prayer. And actually, if you've ever read the whole Serenity Prayer, it's one of the most Christian. It talks about Christ. It talks about sins. It's one of the most Christian prayers you will ever read. And I've been in meetings where there have been rabbis who have been delighted to join in at the end in the community of saying the Lord's Prayer. I think it was in the late 50s or early 60s, Bill Wilson was asked about the Lord's Prayer, and he was asked the same question, and he responded in a letter, which I wish I would have brought a copy of. And Bill felt that that we're not affiliating ourselves with Christianity by saying the Lord's Prayer. It's a tradition because we borrowed that prayer from them because it embodies what we're about, to forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those. There's nothing in there that doesn't embody the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I balked, you know, when I used to come around AA, I balked at anything that talked about God. Anything. And every group is autonomous. We're allowed to borrow things from other organizations. We can borrow things from the Torah. We can borrow things from the Tao. You can share anything you want in a group as long as it doesn't affect AA or as a whole. And as long as we're not implying affiliation or endorsement of some other movement, and I don't think that, in my view, this doesn't imply, this is not endorsement of anything. It's just, we borrow a lot of stuff from a lot of places. Our eighth and ninth step is, I'm sure, is borrowed from some adult probation office somewhere.
You know, I'm sure it is. It's another great question. How do you forgive yourself? And my experience with that was the beginning piece was forgiving the others, that process we described with the observations and prayers. And the balance of that came in step nine. That's where my self-forgiveness came.
I think that covers.
That pretty well cover it? Yeah. One more thing, too, and I want to just share this. At my home group, we've come through a number of changes. And when I was new in AA, the way we set topics and discussion meetings used to work, it doesn't work anymore. And we wound up with a whole bunch of group therapy with no therapist. And just to cover a couple of details, open meetings means everybody in the planet's invited, but only alcoholics share. Closed meeting means only alcoholics are invited. Speaker meeting means one person is either going to tell their story or address some aspect of alcoholism or the recovery program. Discussion meeting means we, as a group, alcoholics, are going to discuss our disease or some aspect of the recovery program. And in my home group, what we finally had to do was to task our chair people with bringing us a topic out of our literature. They read us a paragraph or less from something AA wrote and set a topic in less than 3 minutes. And we talk about recovery every time. I was in a meeting where the chairperson called for a topic from the floor. It was an open meeting. We sat there for 2 or 3 minutes. And finally, a member of OA said, "I'm jonesing bad. Could we talk about fudge?" And I'm going to tell you that you have to figure out where to draw the line in your home group. And what we had to do at our group was draw the line at conference-approved literature, a paragraph or less. You've got 3 minutes to set the topic. And we have some neat stuff going on at our group. Y'all have heard a bunch of it. You're going to hear some more. But we had to get out of the group therapy business. I was in a meeting one time, and somebody said, "I think I may have cancer." He hadn't been to the doctor yet, of course. And he'd think I may have cancer. It wasn't you, but it was a case very similar to Bob's. And I sat there and listened to 25 people talk about people they knew that died from cancer, their own experience with cancer, what they thought about cancer. We had nothing to do with recovery. In my group, we say you take your problems to your sponsor, you bring your solutions to your meeting.
We have an ethic that I grew up with in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not practiced around the country. It's not a view of AA that's real popular. But I got it from when I was early in sobriety. I was asked to chair a meeting, and I went to my sponsor, and I said, "What do I do? Who do I call on?" And he said, "The rule is, don't call on anyone who really wants to share."
Let's stand where we are. And for those of you who weren't here, we're going to whisper the Lord's Prayer, and we're going to have a moment of silence after that. And it's going to be a little bit longer moment of silence, and I'm going to ask you to try to feel the love. Let's have a moment of silence in honor of those who carried this message to us that are gone now. Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever. God bless us all. Thank you. I'll see you at 7:30 for John's talk. Whew. And honored to be here. And I still make mistakes, by the way. I know. That's why I had to tell you. I knew that some of you were concerned about that. I didn't look at the sheet, and we talked about 9 o'clock, and the sheet says 9:30, so we're concerned some people are going to... There's some people that actually read the directions. I don't sponsor any of them, but there are some. And so what we're going to do this morning is first we're going to open with a few moments of silence, and I'm going to ask God to join us. I've already asked him to fill this room with love. Is there any prayer? God. Sometimes the most difficult thing to do on Sunday morning at a conference is to stay here mentally. So I want to mention that, encourage you to stay here. That's what we're going to try to do. Stay here. We got plans for later on the day. Let's don't let them get into this morning. The second one is if you have a cell phone with you, we'd all like to look at it. Please hold them up so we can all get a good look. And while you have it up, see if you have it set the way you'd like to have it. Whatever you want to do is okay with me. If you're on the liver transplant list and need to leave it live, I'm good with that. All right, but make a decision. Let's don't do them by mistake. And anyway, the mistake that I made was I didn't read the directions, and the schedule says 9:30, but we said 9 o'clock a couple of times yesterday. We're concerned there may be people in Fort Myers that read and follow directions, and some of them may be in this fellowship. It's possible. So what we're going to do is to go ahead and open. We're going to handle the questions out of the ask it basket. Bob and I have got a couple of things we call blurbs that sort of don't really fit anywhere else, but we think will fit in here. We're going to do those things for the first half hour, and then we're going to pick back up on the step work out of the big book. So just to give you sort of an overview, and I'll now turn it over to my handsome assistant. Accomplice, actually.
Yeah, let's start with questions.
One word. Why?
I got that one.
Step one, section B says you ain't management. Why's a what management question? The answer is you don't need to know. That's from my sponsor.
Here's one I really like. It says, where in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the word surrender? The little red book uses it. Says, why is the word surrender overused, injected into the text? It's not in the big book, but the principle is throughout the whole thing. It didn't come into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous until World War II, after World War II. But isn't, in effect, aren't we... The word surrender comes as a combination of two Latin words, the word sur, which means above, like in the word surface, and the word render, like in a rendering plant, is to return to. And so the word surrender could be translated out as to return to above, to a return to a power greater than ourself. And it's like a lot of things that have come into the fellowship, as the English language changes, things seem to be more appropriate. Somewhere after World War II, the word surrender started coming into AA because that's, in a sense, it fits this process of turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. We're rendering, we're returning to our source, our Creator, something that we, by through our own self, will have taken away. So I think it's a great word. One of my mentors, Chuck Chamberlain, talked about it, used it a lot. And it really helped me a lot.
I've got a fourth edition concordance, and I agree it's not in the basic text, but in the stories it appears on pages 295, it appears four times on page 300, and once on page 443. So it is something that's really come into our lexicon. And to me, it's almost synonymous with honesty. It's when I really got honest about the situation in my life and how I was conducting myself and what was really happening. What I had to do was to give up the fight of my way. And to me, recovery is getting better following somebody else's directions. And I'm not used to taking orders. I'm used to giving them. And it's so critically important for me to be under somebody else's direction. and surrender is the best word I can come up with on that. I love the quotation on page 164. It says something about more will constantly be disclosed to you and to us. I'm probably not quoting it. And I think that's one of the things that's been disclosed. Here's another one. It says, I have been at the jumping off point for 10 years, and nothing, absolutely nothing, stops the pain. I'm very sad for that. I hope maybe some of what we've done this weekend will help. I got tremendous help out of steps 4 and 9 in particular. The forgiveness process in step 4, where that pain, that poison was dug out of my soul, where I held the icy heart up to the sunlight of the Spirit until it melted. And I received the gift of forgiving other people. It was tremendous for me. Usually when I'm in pain, not always, but usually I'm back to either I'm the victim of the delusion, I can rest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, only I manage well. It's something I think I got to have, or something happened in the past. And this one day at a time has got to be the hardest assignment there is, to live only in this day, to not borrow pain from the past or from the future, but to just live in this day. And I have to pray about that quite a bit, to stay present. And the other thing it says, it asks for the difference between acceptance and resignation. I think resignation, for me, still has a bad attitude. Okay, God, your will, damn it. It kind of is what that feels like to me. And someone helped me with acceptance a long time ago, and they said acceptance does not have to include approval. Acceptance is when I stop on a heart level fighting something over which I have no pain. Over which I have no power. That doesn't mean if somebody's abusing me, I don't stop it. That's not acceptance. But what's important to me is that I don't have to approve of it. I got some things going on in my life with close family members that I'm not very fond of. I accept it. And what that means is that this part of me is not fighting it anymore. I only get a certain amount of spiritual energy. This is just me. I only get a certain amount of spiritual energy on any given day. And if I'm squandering it on things over which I have no power, I won't have enough left for today's assignments that are actually mine. And so acceptance also has to do with there really is a God and it really isn't me. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what I think for sure needs to happen here is not what really needs to happen here. Maybe I'm wrong. I read a book some time ago. It was written by a man who, he's an ordained minister in one of the fairly common Protestant faith, a Methodist or Presbyterian, somewhere along in there, and is also a PhD psychologist or psychiatrist. I'm not sure which, but he was the chaplain of an insane asylum. And he said one day he got this idea, and he polled the patients of the insane asylum, and he asked them this question: would you rather be right or would you rather be free? And overwhelmingly, they said they would rather be right. And back on the days when I was nuts, I would have rather been right also. Today, I would rather be free. And I am convinced that right and free are opposites. They are exact and perfect opposites. Because when I have to be right, then I don't have my own permission to make a mistake. It's not okay that I err. When it's okay that I make mistakes, I'm free. I'm free to be me. I can't make a mistake. God can't turn into something absolutely wonderful. That's who I am. That's who He is. I tend to forget that. The other side of that coin, the Al-Anon side of it, is if I got a string holding you in line and you jump out of line, you pull me with you. It's when it becomes okay with me that you make mistakes, is the other side of that freedom. And I said yesterday, the source of all of my anger is when I'm sure I'm right. I have never been angry when I wasn't also right. So I'm trying to step out of that business because the book tells me I've got to quit being angry. What's the core of that? And for me, it's when I'm sure I'm right. And that's me playing God.
You know, whoever wrote this about being at the jumping off point for 10 years, I understand that. I was a relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous for 7.5 years, and I want you to know something that it's hard to say it, but it's the truth, that the absolute worst years of my life came after I went to my first meeting of AA. And those 7.5 years were brutal because the disease of alcoholism progressed within me. And there's an illusion that I suffered from that I think it's very common in alcoholics, where you think that there's this ultimate bottom, and if it gets painful enough, that'll turn the corner. And I don't think that's true. Because I got to points where it was so horrific and so painful. It's almost, it sounds funny, but it's really true. You think, if I could just feel a little bit better, I could probably get muster up enough to kill myself. I mean, like, as if suicide would be a step up from where you are, right? But that's really true. And there is no ultimate bottom. But in chapter 5, it's funny how you can hear something read 1,000 times and never hear it. It talks about the people in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous who will recover and those who won't. The ones that will die of alcoholism and the ones that won't. And it talks about a line between the two groups. And I was in the group that was dying for 7.5 years. And it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And I was part of that group for 7.5 years. And one of the deceiving things in AA for me that is confusing is I believe from my observation experience that there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous with extreme drinking problems that don't have the same malady that I have. And because of that, when they put the plug in the jug, they don't really have to buy the whole package of AA. And they're fine. They just come to a meeting once in a while just to remind themselves that they shouldn't drink. But they don't really have to devote their life completely to this thing. It talks, and for reference, it talks about that type of person on the bottom of page 20 and top of 21 in the big book. And it calls them, they look exactly like an alcoholic, calls them a hard problem drinker. And it's not that they don't have problems. Some of them can die that. You can die in a drunken automobile accident. But the difference between them and me, it says, in their deal, they say, if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, warning from a doctor, and it gives a list, maybe getting arrested, maybe getting a DUI, maybe your wife's going to leave, your husband's going to leave you. That person has within them, if the pain is bad enough, the resources to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and turn their life around. But the alcoholic doesn't. Because the alcoholic's problem is lack of power. We do not have of ourselves what it takes to do that. We are powerless. And that's, so what was confusing to me is I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a minimizer because I'm lazy. So, you know, I sit in the meetings, right? I sit in a group. And I know I got to do AA. But I'm always looking around for the guy who's doing the minimum and then I want to do what he does, right? That's my nature. I'm not a maximizer. I'm a minimizer. I take a minimalist approach to AA. And that is a deadly approach. A deadly approach. And I'm a maximizer today. I try. It's my attitude towards Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not what do I have to do. It's what can I do. It's really in the feet. It's not in the pain. There's alcohol. As we sit here in this room this weekend, there are alcoholics dying in emotional anguish and loneliness. And if pain was the thing that eventually got us sober, they would be sober. But you can pain yourself all the way to death and never get it. It's in the feet. Until you get to the point where you're willing to buy the whole package. That is my experience.
Got another question up there?
Another question. Where does Scott get his Hawaiian shirts? No. I don't know where the devil gets in these sisters.
Ever smart mouth, anybody's going to follow you with a microphone.
See? I don't think my life's unmanageable. That's an example right there. Why it's unmanageable, I don't connect the dots. He gets up here next. I would like your opinion on men sponsoring women in AA and women sponsoring men. Oh. I think in a perfect world, men should sponsor men and women should sponsor women. I don't know how to say this and not sound. It has been my observation, and I don't know why it is this way, that often in areas, women have a harder time finding women that are sober over 20 years, that are working the steps and doing 12-step work, that are activists in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why that is. It's not that they're good members. I think sometimes it's a matter of maybe for priorities. Maybe they have children and families and stuff. I don't know. But it seems to be a common problem in AA. My sponsor sponsors a lot of people, but probably 10% of the people he sponsors are women. They're all sober. Most of them are sober over 30 years. Some of them are sober a little less, like 15 and 10. But a lot of them, he sponsors a lot of women. Because what do you do if you're a woman and you're 30 years sober and you live in a community where the only other active members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are women are sober 5 years? Where do you go? I don't know. Is it good that men sponsor women? Probably not. But I don't condemn it. I just realize it's sometimes an unfortunate, not near best case reality. But it seems to be the way it is sometimes. Do I think it's a problem? Maybe. Is there an answer? Yeah, the women need to step up more and stay more involved. And it's a problem in my home group. We have strong men in our group, but the women, you know, women come up to me at the detox sometimes and say, who would you recommend as a sponsor? I'm embarrassed to say this. Sometimes I have to think. You don't have to do that with the men. They do that. You recommend a guy sponsor. I got 30 guys just on the horizon right around me in that meeting I can point to. And I don't know. Anyway, that's my view.
I got a couple on this one. I have had two sponsors who sponsored women. One of them did it very successfully. The other one I dropped because he started sleeping with other women, and he was married. And I judged him. And it's the reason that I changed sponsors. I am personally not healthy enough to sponsor women. I have not seen an unattractive woman since the summer I turned 12. And I'll tell you right now, we laugh about that, and it's the truth. And it's the truth. And I'm not ever going to be that healthy. I just don't think I am. My opinion on what you should do is I agree with whatever your sponsor says. And I'm not hiding behind that. I actually mean that. I have had one occasion where a guy I sponsored really saw a situation like Bob is describing and wanted to sponsor one that's worked out pretty well. I don't need to be doing that. And that's just how it is for me. And I don't think I can go past that. I know there's some good being done. I know there's some trouble. Let's see what... Is that it? I think that's all we got for questions. Let me do a couple of these blurbs. Could you hand me that one right there? Yeah, thanks. We'll talk a little bit about anonymity. I think we as a society are maybe a little bit confused. And this is Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, AA Conference Approved Literature, page 265. A couple of the original 100 talking about anonymity. And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. Forgive me for reading this much, but you'll notice Bob and I have given our last names a number of times here. That is in keeping with the tradition of anonymity. We are not a secret society. You know, when you go to the hospital to visit a member of your home group and you walk up to the desk and tell them, you know, what room is Wall Street Dan in, they're not going to be a chainsaw Mike, isn't he here? Janet from another planet, right? They don't have a room number for them. And I think it's important that they be able to find us. And page 265, Ernie G. of Toledo commenting on what he saw to be an increase of anonymity within AA today was as compared with the old days, said, I made a lead over to Jackson, Michigan one night, and everybody's coming up to me saying, I'm Joe, I'm Pete. Then one of the guys says, safe journey home. If you get into any trouble, give me a buzz. Later I said to the fellow who was with me, you know, suppose we did get into any trouble on the way home. How could we tell anyone in AA? We don't know anyone's last name. They get so doggone carried away with this anonymity that it gets to be a joke. I had a book, evidently one of the small address books compiled by early members of or their wives, with the first 100 names, first and last names, telephone numbers, and where they lived. And then he says, Dr. Bob's views on anonymity remained clear in the recollection of Akron's Joe P. Though it was not the custom in the mid-1940s to give AA talks to anyone except drunks, Joe noted a few members formed an unofficial public information committee that started to speak to Rotary and Kiwanis clubs throughout the state. Quote, of course, we first had to get permission from Bob. He said you were not supposed to break your anonymity in the newspapers or on the radio. But he didn't think we could get any place if people didn't know we belonged to AA. He had the firm conviction that you should let yourself be known as an AA member in the community, and he was always sure to tell you about it every time you met him. Pretty interesting. I think there are exceptions to that. I know a federal judge who's in AA who really tries to, he needs to stay anonymous, because I know some other people that have really good reasons. I think that's great. But by and large, I think it's important. And I got another one, too. This is, forgive me, a hot button for me. This thing about giving phone numbers to our newcomers, what a waste of time is that? When I had 100 days, I had 100 numbers. You know how many I dialed, right? Same number you did, right? Yeah. And what I started doing, and I tasked the men that I sponsor with this, is we don't give our phone numbers to new men. We get theirs. We exchange. They get ours, but we get theirs. And we take the responsibility of calling them twice in the next 3 days. That's what I lay on the men I sponsor, and I lay it on myself as an assignment. This thing about the hand of AA always being there, what would happen if we could reach down just a little bit further? They're dying, you know. What would happen? He can't pick up the phone and call me. It's nothing for me to pick up the phone and say, hey, Charlie, I met you in the back room yesterday. We exchanged phone numbers. I talk to 5 guys every day that are in recovery. You're on today's list. How's it going? I'm going to the Nolan's Hill Road meeting tonight, 8 o'clock. Meet me there. We'll have a cup of coffee. I've got a speaker tape you might enjoy. It's nothing for me to call him. He can't call me. They're dying. You think about that. See what it does to you. It touches me deeply. Because I know people that say it was the difference that one of us called them. You read your big book. You read Bill's story. Bill didn't call Ebby. Ebby called Bill. And then he went back. Didn't say he was invited back. He went back. Carry the message. What would happen if we could reach it out just a little bit further? I think it's so important. I say one more thing. I'm going to let Bob do a couple of these. There is no 13th tradition. When I got sober in the summer of 1984, it was the custom when the basket came by to put $1 in the basket. A pack of cigarettes was 52 cents. It's not our custom, it's not our 13th tradition to put a dollar in the basket. There is an upper limit to how much money you can contribute to AA. The central office will accept up to $2,000 from an individual. AA World Services will accept up to $2,000 from an individual. You must identify yourself as an AA member or they won't take it, either one of them. Wonder why they had to set a limit. It must be because there are some AA members who have become so responsible and feel that they have a debt that's so heavy they can't repay it, that financially they are supporting and would support at a level beyond that, and that our fellowship, our delegates, and our conference have decided that there should be a limit to that. They have a thing they call the birthday club, and that's every year on your AA birthday. You send a dollar for every year you're sober to your central office and to AA World Services and maybe to your group. You might think about that the next time the basket comes by.
Bob's still an alcoholic. The custom, I think, in AA has always been the price of a drink in the basket. A little sideline. You know, AA is the only organization in the world that has actually paid money to hire attorneys to not take money that has been willed to them by family members of people who got sober. I don't think there's another organization on the earth that has ever hired lawyers and paid money not to take money. Matter of fact, you try to explain that to somebody and they just look at you like... And we're a little different here. I mean, this is, you know, when it says that our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern, this is the only organization where you the highest you get is servant. It's backwards from the rest of the world. AA is the only place where you come in a big shot and work your way up to servant. That's really true, too. I mean, because everybody, they're new, they're a big shot. Oh, they just, you're not even here a week, you know, what's wrong with AA, what should happen, and what's, if you're lucky, you become a servant. There's a thing that you don't hear talked about too much, but it seems to be my experience and the experience of a lot of us, is that there's a journey that happens through the steps, and there's a backwash in the journey. In other words, I take a step, and then either results sometimes or later as it moves something from up here down into here, into my heart. And, you know, when I first got sober, I started praying. When I was fairly early in sobriety, I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I started moving through the steps the best I could do at the time with the information I had. But sometimes some of this stuff comes later. The coming to believe thing with me came down the road, way beyond step two, that it really actually happened. And it's like you take a step on one level, and then later on it happens to you at a deeper level down inside. And my experience with coming to believe, and that's really what... And connecting with God is really, they say, is the purpose of this, to connect us with a power greater than ourselves, which can solve our problem. And what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is I came to AA, and they told me to do things that I felt awkward doing, like praying, and I started doing it. So I don't know if it's going to do any good, and I'm not sure about it, but I started doing it, and then I started doing some other things and turning my will and my life over and making some amends and etc. And very slowly I started to experience something. It started up here by noticing things, and then it started moving down in here to a place where I knew, started really knowing some things. And my experience with coming to believe was very similar to a thing that occurred years ago over in England. I was over there a year and a half ago, and to my delight, I noticed that a lot of the streets of London still had gas lamps. But today, those lamps are lit by these electric computer-controlled starters that at twilight, optic sensors get the reduction of light, cause the gas thing to turn, and the electric starter starts and lights them. But years ago, that wasn't the case. Years ago, they were lit by a guy who would go up and down the streets with a long pole with a flame on the end, and he had a key, and he would turn the gas on, he'd reach up with the pole and light the lamp. And you could climb up to the top of the highest building in London at twilight and look out over the city, and you could not see where this lamp lighter was. But you could always see where he'd been. And I could sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at 3 years sober, and I didn't know, I couldn't see God, but boy, could I see where he'd been. And somewhere that experience moves this thing down into a place where you just eventually start to know that something's working. Because the coincidences, the endless series of coincidences, from the moment I turned my focus and attention towards him in prayer, things started to happen in my life. And you probably had the same experience. You're new and you're crazy and you're bouncing off the walls mentally and emotionally, you don't know what's going on, and you're about ready to destroy yourself, and you ask for help and go to a meeting and there's somebody there talking about what's going on with you exactly. Somebody doesn't even know you. I mean, who orchestrates that? Right? And that doesn't happen once or twice. That happens over and over and over again. When I, in early sobriety, I got the perfect job. The perfect job. It was in a, a teenage treatment center, and they gave me room and board, just enough money to go to meetings and start making amends and putting a dollar in the basket. It was great. It wasn't the job I wanted. God had that, but it was the perfect job for me. I got to watch some stuff in AA that if those of you that stay in the trenches will get to see. And I highly encourage people to do 12-step work and go to the detoxes in the jails, because you will see something you won't see anywhere else in Alcoholics Anonymous. You will get to look into the eyes of men and women that are more dead than alive. You will get to see their hopelessness. You will get to see the scars on their wrists from the multiple suicide attempts. You will get to see the scabs from where they, whatever drug they did, they picked their skin off. You will see people who will never see their children because they've been taken away from them. You will see people whose parents will never talk to them again. You will see people that have buried themselves in debt so deeply that you can't live long enough to dig yourself out of that. And then in three years, maybe you see that same guy in the back of the room and he's got his kids with him for the first time. And they're looking at him with those daddy is my hero eyes, right? You see homeless guys, and I've seen this so many times, it's amazing. Homeless guys coming into a meeting and crying because they just bought their first house. People whose parents would never have anything to do with them, and their parents are at a meeting giving them a token or a cake. And you don't just see that in Alcoholics Anonymous once or twice. We see things in AA on a regular basis that Hollywood would want to make a frickin' miniseries about. You know what I mean? Amazing stuff. We're kind of blasé about it, actually. After a while, you get callous to it. Somebody come up and say, oh, you know, remember that homeless guy? So he just bought a house. Yeah, where's the coffee? Yeah. No, I mean, really, we get a little blasé about that, really. And we're right in the middle of the vortex of miracles on this planet. You can't see anything like that. And you really want to see it up close and personal. Stay in the trenches. Okay.
For those of you who came right on time for the 9:30 meeting, it'll help me a lot. Bob and I screwed up. It's actually me. Failed to check the schedule and announce 9. And so what we started this morning at 9 was just some blurbs, just some little concepts and ideas. We have not done any of the step stuff, and we're going to start that now. And I want to thank you all again. I know I'm overthanking you, but good heavenly days, I have had such a wonderful time. It's amazing to me what I stand here and receive. We're going to start on step 8. The big book runs steps 8 and 9 together. That's pretty common. With the men that I sponsor, I don't do it that way. I like for them to start by taking the list. We'll begin on page 76. If they followed the big book directions on the 4-step, which is a very unusual way to do it, they will have a list of people they've harmed taken from their resentment inventory and also from their sexual misconduct inventory that makes up the majority of step 8. Now, there are some others. Having heard his 5th step, I probably heard some more. He probably heard some more. So we completed step 5, first half. He went home. He took his book down from the shelf. He sat for an hour with God reviewing the first 5 steps. He checked himself on step 6. He used the step 6 prayer if he needed it. He prayed the 7th step prayer. He calls me the next day or so if he comes up with any more. And tomorrow morning, we start on step 8. I want him to go ahead and extract the data and then sit for a session and see what else he can think of. I give him the ones that I heard in his 5th step. And then we need to stop and talk about what these amends look like. And I'd like to make this observation. This is just me. This is just how I do it. The person you're going to make amends to is not final authority on what that amend is. I am, if I sponsored you. I am and you are together prayerfully. But we're not going to ask you to turn your will and life over to the care of someone who may roundly hate you. I told you, Big Ken Sweeney, who I used to sponsor, said before he gets over, he hated everybody and he wished there was more of them. And if you'd gone to Ken to make amends, he would have bashed you for the rest of your life. So we're not asking you to turn your will and life over to their care. So you and I need to sit and prayerfully come up with, and let's go down that list one at a time, and let's talk about what this amend is supposed to be. And it's amazing to me how many names are on the list that you didn't hurt them. I mean, we're going to amend means to make right again. It's to repair damage. Did you hurt this? How did you hurt this guy? Well, I didn't. Well, then scratch him off the list. And let's take a look at the ones that you hurt. And let's talk about what this amend should look like. Oh, you beat him out of $100? Well, you need to have a $100 bill on you when you go to make amends to this guy. Or you need to have a 10 and tell him that you'll send him a 10 once a month for the next 9 months. That's how that goes. I find five prayers in the readings on these steps, and I'd like to cover those. Page 76, the first full paragraph, or last full paragraph at the bottom of the page, if you count up four lines above this, it says, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Sounds like a prayer to me. Top of page 79, all of these reparations, means to repair, take innumerable forms. There are some general principles which we find guiding. Once again, principles, not motives. Finding ourselves, we've decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask, that's a prayer, that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. Powerful stuff. I'm told that if I want to strengthen a muscle in my body, if I want to tighten up my stomach muscles, what am I supposed to do? Crunches, right? I'm supposed to do exercises for them. You said you wanted stronger faith. Here's your chance to exercise it. I don't know of a better exercise for faith than step 9. Top of page 80. Very first line, before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. So there's another indication of